At this time, the call is being recorded.
Is that echo back?
Yes. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the RAA Sub-Team B call. And on the line, we have Tatiana Kramsova, Cheryl Langdonore, Michele Nilon, Holly Reich, Steve Metalitz, Elisa Cooper, Mark Trachtenberg, Christina Rosette, and for staff, we have Heidi Ulrich, Liz Gaster, Marika Koenig, Margie Milam, and Glenda Saint-Jerry, myself. Siva Mutasami, we have tried to call out to him, but we get no response from his line. So over to you, Steve. Thank you. And I'll put myself on mute.
Thank you very much, Gwen. Thanks again, Glenn. Is everybody still with us here? I think we have lost our echo thanks to Glenn's self-sacrifice. So why don't we get started? I think our job here is to plunge back into our document, starting at item 11. I noticed that Margie has circulated an updated version that reflects what we discussed last time. I've not even had a chance to look at that yet. And I guess what I would suggest is that people take a look at that, and if you see any discrepancies or problems, please note those on the list, and we'll get those squared away. But I think that's probably the best way to proceed on that. On number 11, I think the first one up here, 11.1, is simply to for the RAA to reflect that the way that the GNSO Council recommends consensus policy has changed with the GNSO restructuring, and I think it's pretty much of a technical change. Unless anybody has any other comments on that, why don't we move ahead to 11.2. Holly has identified for us a number of reports or papers from the Security and Stability Advisory Committee that might be relevant here, and I think it boiled down to just a couple of them, 28 and 40, if I'm not mistaken, that would be prime for discussion now. And I know we have Dave Piscatello on the line as well. Let me just say before we start the discussion on our topic 11.2, just to recall that all we're doing here is trying to set priorities and see if there's anything that we need to flag as far as impact on consensus policy, not necessarily whether we'd agree with putting all of these topics into the, or, you know, all these provisions into the RAA. That's a later stage in the process. So let me open the floor for discussion on 11.2, in particular on those two, on what is in those two SSAC advisories, 28 and 40. So please just let me know if you want to be recognized on this. I know some of you are on Adobe Connect, but not everybody. So the floor is open on 11.2. Okay, Holly wants to be heard. Anybody else? Let's start with Holly. Go ahead. Holly, go ahead. I wonder if you're muted. Holly, are you with us?
Our line is now open, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been muted. I must be the source of echo.
Not the
okay. The reason I put these up was, and all of them really, was because SAC, a lot of the advisories make sense. I was looking at the conversation between McKenna and Dave online, and I do take Dave's point that these advisories are not only for about registrants, they're also about the safety and security of the registrants as well, and that taking on board some of these recommendations will in fact increase the safety and security of grants as well, and we should be thinking about the interests of all of the parties, just the registrars here. These are some of the things that will actually help. So, you know, I'd be interested to hear both Dave and Michaela on these.
Okay. Thank you very much, Holly. Did Dave or Michaela, did either of you want to contribute anything at this point?
I think I've made most of my comments on, online.
This is Dave,
email.
Right?
Yeah, this is
you
Dave.
You need
sorry.
To identify yourself for the transcript.
Yeah, apologies. I think that there are several different dynamics here. Certainly, there's a long laundry list of measures that the FAC documents have enumerated, and trying to sort out which of those is appropriate for a consensus policy, and which of those actually creates the ability for the market to differentiate is I think a subject for for considerable discussion, and that's one of the points I wanted to make during the email exchange.
Okay. Any other comments on this? Well, what I take away from the email exchange and from the comments on this call is that these are important issues, at least the ones that Holly has identified in her as far as Advisory 40, Advisory 28. They're obviously we're not deciding here whether these all ought to go into the RAA, but it seems as though there are a lot of strong registrant interests here, and so I guess I would recommend that we identify this as a high priority item without prejudging whether particular ones ought to be in the RAA. I see Michaela has his hand up. Holly, I don't know if you wanted to be heard again, but let's start with Michaela.
Well, I mean, okay, there's been a bit of to-ing and fro-ing between Dave and myself about this, and I think we probably actually agree, though it may not be 100% apparent from our to-ing and fro-ing. I mean, the thing, I suppose the key thing is, as Dave has pointed out, I mean, that, there are different business models, and some of the things that the FSAC are talking about would be suitable for certain types of registrant and certain types of registrar. But it's just the problem I have, I suppose, is that some people will pick up an FSAC document and kind of assume that every single recommendation should be binding to all registrars and in all situations. And that's something that would scare the living hell out of me. Because, I mean, as things stand, even implementing anti-fraud measures in terms of orders that we receive so that we don't get inundated with chargebacks. I mean, last week I was told by one charming gentleman that he was going to sue us and report us to just about every single agency on the face of the planet simply because we wanted to make sure that the order was a valid order. So, the thing is that, trying to balance security with practical ability for people, both from the registrar side and the registrant side, for everybody to actually be able to do business, is something that shouldn't be forgotten.
Right. Thank you. Anybody else have comments on this point? Holly, go ahead.
Yes, just a final one. Later on in the matrix, there is an discussion about a code of practice. Now, if a code of practice is voluntary but it's seen as a best practice, at some point some of the recommendations that are made may be more appropriately in something that's a best practice, as Dave was saying, a market differentiator. So maybe in the back of everybody's minds there is room for saying some things may be appropriate for something that looks like a registrar's best code of practice, and maybe some of that would sit here.
Okay, thank you, Holly. Any other comments on this?
No.
Well, this is Steve. I hear what Michaela is saying, that not all the recommendations should be binding on all the registrars. The question, I guess, is whether there are any recommendations here that potentially should be binding on all registrars, because that's really what we're about in this discussion. So, Michaela, I guess you have your hand up, so maybe you could answer whether you think there are any recommendations here or, that should be binding on all registrars. Go ahead, please.
Well, this is something that has come up in previous public meetings and things. I mean, it's in everybody's interest that registrars operate secure systems and that they comply with best security practices. The problem to date, I think, has been identifying which security practices are appropriate to apply. And I think, I don't know if Dave might want to jump in here because he's probably in a better position to come, but I think Dave would agree that the PCI compliance was something that wasn't abhorrent. Dave,
go ahead.
Sure. I agree that that's, it would be, I think, well received across almost every community if every one of the registrars, were PCI compliant, and that would go a long way to, to dealing with some of the mitigation of malicious domains that, that we see today. I think that there are in SAC 40, there are sort of categories of measures that could be implemented, and then within the categories, there are certain examples of specific measures that are taken by the e-financials or the e-merchants to create a higher assurance that the party that they're doing business with is actually a legitimate party, is actually occupies the address that he provides in the contact, can be contacted through the telephone number and electronic mail address. And one of the things that I imagine speaking as a member of FSAC and also as a member of the anti-phishing working group, one of the things that I think would be very high on the list of recommended RIA amendments would be increased registration verification processes, so that we could dramatically mitigate malicious registrations by simply raising the bar for a registrant to demonstrate that he is who he claims to be. And so there are measures like phone call backs and electronic email confirmation, click backs and the like that have been used successfully by eBay and Amazon and others, and they've also been used by many banks in the United States. And those are the kinds of things that I think would be extremely important from the perspective of some of the communities that fed FSAC with some of the comments.
Okay, thank you. Are there other comments on this point? I think Holly has her hand up. Anybody else? Holly, go ahead.
Just a comment. I would hate to have the FSAC recommendations lost just because we can't agree which one should be mandatory or not. I think it is worthy of a discussion, a further discussion, perhaps not here, but perhaps in other fora, to say, these things are, some of these things should be mandatory because they will increase the safety and security of the system. And while I appreciate what Michaela is saying, which is probably not all or appropriate, and maybe some proceeds can go elsewhere, I'd hate to lose the whole box and dice because we can't sort this in an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I think that point is well taken. I guess my suggestion, again, would be to say that while not all recommendations in SAC 40 are appropriate for the RAA, it would be a priority to determine which ones are. PCI has been mentioned. I think the registrant verification we've dealt with elsewhere in this document, but that could be a separate discussion. But would people be comfortable with saying that that it is a high priority to determine which of these are appropriate for inclusion in RAA?
I would think.
Okay, without objection, then we'll ask the staff to note that, and we'll move on to 11.3. This is one of Danny Younger's proposals. No registrar may take any action by way of electronic or paper registration agreements with registered name holders that serves to thwart the intent of ICANN's consensus policies. Are there any comments on whether this would be a high priority item or a high priority topic from our perspective? No comments on this? Holly and then Michaela?
I'm not sure. Do you know what he actually means by this? I'm sorry. I was a little bit puzzled.
No, I'm not entirely sure.
Michaela,
go ahead, Holly. I'm sorry.
No, it's hard to make any kind of call on this at all. I'm not sure at all what he means. Maybe Michaela knows.
Okay, why don't we ask Michaela, and then I think we have Siva also in the queue. So, Michaela, go ahead.
I kind of echo Holly to a certain point in that it's not very clear what he's aiming at. I don't understand what he's aiming at. I mean, the only thing that I can possibly think of is that, well, the only thing I can see as being a potential problem would be, let's say, if a consensus policy was in clear breach of a national law or something that was binding to me but might not have been binding to some other registrar. But honestly, without further insight into it, it's very hard to make a call on that.
Okay. Thank you. Siva, and then Cheryl and Margie. Siva, go ahead. Are you with us?
Hello. I think 11.3 should be a high priority item. Because resistance security is important. Resistance data security is very important. It can't be commercially abused or politically abused. So the information that is disclosed by the registrant to the registrar has to be secure.
Okay. So, Siva, was that a comment on 11.3 or 11.2?
It's on 11.3.
11.3. Okay, thank you. Cheryl and then Margie.
Siva, I think if what you said is applied to 11.2, I understand and I agree. I don't actually see, and I think building on the questions that Holly and that Michele raised in their need to try and even understand what it is that Danny is proposing in 11.3, which certainly in my reading of it, and I was going to try and propose at least my limited understanding of what it may be that Danny was asking for here, has no particular security implications. So you may wish to review your statement in view of it being applicable to 11.3 or 11.2. But that said, again, I had assumed, and I guess I'm building on extensive interaction with Danny over the years, which I know many of us have had, that what Danny was trying to ask for here was a section in an RAA that was an overarching high-level piece of contracted agreement that says a deliberate intent to go through, around, under, or avoid an outcome or part of a contracted arrangement or ICANN consensus policy is a bad thing. So that's my take on what he was intending. That said, what level of priority we give it is another matter altogether.
Okay, thank you. Margie, go ahead.
I think I'm saying the same thing Cheryl was saying. I think when I read his comment, it's that, you know, we have consensus policies out there that have specific requirements, transfers and who is and UDRP, and that the agreement with the registrant and the registrar shouldn't in any way circumvent that or say that those provisions don't apply and that there was some sort of waiver of it. I think that's and I think that's, at least from my standpoint, what that would address.
Okay, thank you, Margie. I guess one question from that is, doesn't the RAA already provide that, since it does provide that the registrars have to abide by consensus policies? Holly, I think you had your hand up.
I did. Just a comment. Isn't this really about compliance, and haven't we already discussed it, and can we please move on?
Yep. Okay. Well, to summarize, I think there is some uncertainty about this and also about whether it's already covered, so I would suggest we mark that as a low priority, at least until we have some more information on it. Is there objection to that? Okay. Let's move on to item 12. There are actually three or four things here that have to do with the arbitration process for deaccreditation or termination by ICANN of a registrar's ability to take registrations and the appeals process there. Several of these come from staff, and then Holly has raised the point of the length of the appeal process. So, if there is, I know Dave Giza is not on the line today, but if Margie or others, if staff have any comments on this that would that you'd like to make, that would be great, or anybody else. So the floor is open on any of these. I think all these are kind of related, so the floor is open on any of these topics in item 12. Margie, anybody else? Margie, go ahead.
Sure, I just wanted to comment that on these, I think these would be a high priority for us. We've had a bit of input from the legal department, and they've asked us to include these in the amendment proposals.
Okay, thank you. Do you think that would extend to this issue of the length of the appeal process that Holly raised? Obviously, it's not as part of the exactly as part of the staff recommendations, but I do think it's pretty closely linked to that. So unless there's objection, why don't we mark this section as high priority, all of these items, and move on to number 13 about the trademark appendix. This really deals with, as I understand it, with the situation, with the circumstances in which a registrar is accredited to take registrations in additional top-level domains. They may start with some number and then over time add more TLDs, and obviously when we get to new TLDs, that's going to happen more and more often, and I think the staff's proposal here is to look at streamlining this process. But why don't we open item 13 to any comments either from the staff or from anybody else. I have Michaela's hand, and Margie, I don't know if you still were seeking recognition, but Michaela, why don't you go ahead?
taking myself off mute.
Okay.
This is something that I think really does need to be dealt with, especially if we're going to see an explosion in terms of new TLDs. It would make a lot more sense, and I'm not a lawyer, obviously, just to have something in saying, you know, registrar is accredited for all existing and future TLDs, instead of forcing people to do lots of paper shuffling and killing lots of trees every time there's a new TLD added. The amount of paperwork and everything else that's involved in going live with a new TLD when you're dealing with multiple back-end providers and everything else means there's contracts flying left, right, and center. Adding to that is probably not desirable, so anything that streamlines it would be good in my mind. The only thing I don't understand is what's this thing about the trademark. I don't fully understand the trademark comment here. So if somebody could clarify what they mean by that, it would be helpful.
Sure, I can comment on that. And
go ahead, Margie.
Yeah, this is Margie. The way it works right now, you sign an appendix for every TLD, and you also sign an appendix if you want to have a license of the ICANN logo, you know, a little picture and the ICANN name. And a lot of that's obviously pretty standard stuff, and so we just thought it'd be easier to incorporate it in the body of the agreement as opposed to going through the extra work of requiring, you know, an additional signed document. On the point with respect to the new GTLD's appendixes, the one thing I wanted to highlight is that we don't want to have written appendices for every new GTLD, but we do want to have the ability to not pre-authorize them, because if there's a registrar that's not in good standing or is subject to a breach notice or something like that, we would we would think it's probably best not to authorize them for to carry a new extension. But we're envisioning an electronic method of doing that as opposed to a written one, the way it's set up right now. And David Giza would have more details on that, but that's kind of my understanding of where they want to go with this process.
Right. Okay, I have Christina and then Michaela.
I'm losing my voice, so I'm just going to make this quick. I had posted a question on the chat, namely, I'd be interested in hearing from staff, and I guess also from Michaela, from the registrar perspective, of how that recommendation 13.2 would work, where there are, and I think we should assume that there will be in new GTLD, that there will be some fairly significant registrant eligibility and verification requirements that the registry operator is going to want to make darn sure that participating registrars have agreed to essentially accommodate and abide by. So I'm just trying to figure out how you mesh those two, and there it may be that there's something I'm missing, but it would be helpful to have the explanation.
Keith, can I comment, Margie?
Yeah, I think we had Michaela in line next, and then you, Margie.
Okay.
Michaela, go ahead.
Well, just coming back on what Margie was saying, I mean, the idea of, you know, registrar in good standing, I mean, I don't know if that's in the current RAA anywhere. I don't think it is. So, I mean, adding something in to say that, you know, the adding additional TLDs being added to the accreditation would be based on the registrar being in good standing and not having, you know, various breach notices. To deal with Christina's query, that's already kind of dealt with at the moment, because for every TLD that a registrar is accredited for, you're accredited with ICANN on one side, and then you're accredited slash contracted with the registry on the other side. So, for example, if you were to look at the ICANN accredited registrar list at the moment, you'll see beside our registrar that we're accredited for every single GTLD that currently exists. The reality is, though, that we're not actually accredited with the registries for all of them, because we haven't actually gone through that entire process with each one. And depending on the various rules, policies, and procedures, and everything else that the registry operators have themselves, that would be why we aren't. So it's actually kind of dealt with already. That kind of answers your question.
Thank you, Michaela. Margie?
Yeah, I'm basically saying the same thing that Michaela's saying. In the registry agreement with the registrars, that's where all those obligations fall into place. So if you have to, you know, if it's .biz, for example, and it has to be a business, then there's some representation or some appendix that deals with that.
So just so that I'm clear then, the 13.2 really goes to the registrar-registry relationship from ICANN's perspective. Yeah? I'm just kind of trying to kind of square the circle.
It removes loads of dead wood. I mean, being blunt about it. I mean, if somebody signed an RAA with ICANN, say in 2004, for example, for them to be able to offer .tel or any of the other TLDs that were launched since they signed their contract with ICANN, they'd have to have signed an appendix document for each TLD with ICANN and submit that in multiple copies, and then they'd have to get in contact with each registry operator and go through the entire process with them. So I think what ICANN staff are trying to do here is to bring some kind of level of sanity to it, so that if, for example, I don't know what figures people are throwing around at the moment in terms of new TLDs. Let's say hypothetically there were 50 new TLDs launched over a 3-month period, then you can imagine there'd be an absolute mountain of paper being sent to Marina Del Rey, which realistically, while it's important that ICANN gets that, if they have something here, it does away with lots of extra paper.
Got it. Okay. I mean, I get it, and I think maybe the recommendation should be a little clearer that it's not intended to supplant whatever additional criteria might be contained in the registrar-registry agreement.
As I understand it, in essence, this is the step by which a registrar becomes eligible to enter into an agreement with a registry. It doesn't take out that second step. It makes the first step more efficient.
No. I understand, and I think, frankly, making it efficient is great. I just think that for a lot of folks who may not be as familiar with the process as many of the folks on this call, not having that additional clarifier, I think, is going to get a lot of people really confused.
Okay.
So maybe it's just a matter of amending the staff recommendation.
I think that's a good point.
I agree with her.
Any other comments on this? If not, then I think can we say that these topics 13 are high priorities, but 13.2 needs to be clarified that it doesn't supplant the registrar and registry reaching an agreement.
That works for me.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, then without objection, we'll wrap up 13 and move on to 14. 14 is deals with its label group liability, and it's to state that if you have registrar A and B under common control, if A is directing or assisting B and B is committing serious violations that would cause it to be suspended or have some other discipline against it, then registrar A should also be subject to those sanctions. That it isn't a part of the RAA now, as I understand it. So we'll open the floor to any comments on this item 14. Cheryl has her hand up, so why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. There's sufficient delay that I don't even see I have my hand up at the moment. So I know Holly and I, there I am, I'm official, are a long way away, the other side of the pond, but boy, these bits and bytes are taking some time to get back to me this morning. The priority for this, I think, which is what we're discussing, should be very, very high, because it is a matter that certainly from the community and the at-large perspective is very, very important to have teased out and discussed, and if needs be, clarified as part of the RAA. it's a huge bone of contention from our community's point of view, where you can do this sort of chessboard risk thing, or at least that's how the end user tends to see it. That said, I should also note that there are some problems and risks that would need to be looked at if you do these blanket things. I'm not saying whether that's good or bad, but for example, where Australia recently deregistered and is taken through the courts one particular part of a group because it failed its security and its agreements quite highly, no other part of the group was, nor should it have been, affected. But that was based on cold, hard fact, and indeed was tested in law, not just because all the parts of the group were under one macro label. Would it have been appropriate or good for the end users for a blanket rule to apply? So I want it to be a high priority, but I'm a little nervous about outcome unless it's very, very detailed discussion and analysis going on.
Okay. Thank you, Cheryl. Siva, I think you had your hand up. If you could speak slowly because you don't have a great connection here, but please speak.
I agree with the proposal that Registrar A should be subject to sanctions in case of any violations on the part of Registrar B. And by extension, this clause should also apply to the actions of resellers. So I'm not sure if the same point implies that. The point is the registrar should also be responsible for the actions of resellers. And knowingly or unknowingly, Mr. Lee said in chat that the term knowingly needs to be added with the implication that in case the registrar A does not know about the actions of registrar B, then he's not responsible. So I don't agree with that. The registrar A is accountable no matter if he is aware or has knowledge or not, because he is accountable for the actions of the registrar B on the grounds that he is not supposed to be negligent of the actions of the registrar B. Thank you.
Okay, so if Siva, if I understood you correctly, you were supporting this as a high priority item, but you thought it should be broader and apply even when Registrar A is simply negligent in how it deals with its fellow Registrar B. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, exactly, yes.
Okay, thank you. I think Michaela had his hand up and Holly also, so we'll continue with those two.
Yeah, the main thing, I mean, I've been following a bit of what Cheryl's been saying as well. I mean, one thing I would be very wary of is kind of a blanket introduction of anything. I think a key word to throw in there would be knowingly. I mean, if it's one thing that one registrar may do something to assist another, but it's a very different thing whether they do it knowingly or not. That's something I just think should be put on the record.
Okay. Thank you. Holly, I think you were next.
I think I'd support that, and Cheryl, I think it's a really dangerous thing to have something blanket that automatically apportions blame when it may not be appropriate at all. And if you would need to write in some phrases of natural justice here before you start to say one is automatically guilty for the actions of another. But I do take the point that Registrar A should not be able to hide just by saying somebody else did it when in fact there would be a direct correlation between the two actions, and it would be of a nature that you can use that knowingly, or there's plenty of legal phrases there where responsibility should be sheeted home, and there are plenty of instances where responsibility should not be. So it's a bit dangerous, let's put it that way.
Okay, any other comments on this? If not, I think there was a lot of sentiment to making this a high priority, also a lot of concern that any provision here be carefully drawn to make sure it isn't too broad. So I think that probably sums it up on item 14. Let's move on to item 15. We're making great progress here. I just want to tell everybody we're making up for lost time. Item 15 deals with UDRP issues. 15.1 is regarding who is data, that when the who is data is inaccurate to the extent that the UDRP petition has to be amended, in other words, the real owner of the domain name is not who's listed in the who is, the registrar has to explain why the published information was inaccurate or incomplete at the time the petitioner submits a UDRP petition. That's 15.1. I think 15.2 and 15.3 are really dealing with I take it back. They're not exactly the same thing. So let's start with 15.1. Any comments on this? I see Michaela has his hand up. Anybody else? Go ahead, Michaela.
It's a bit scary, that 15.1, just looking at it. Just from our own experience, we've had some very interesting experiences where registrants have decided to put our contact details in for domain names that weren't even registered with us, which has led to some interesting dead trees landing on my desk. The problem here is determining what actually is accurate. Now, I understand why they're doing it, but it's just there is something there about it being, it's a bit scary in some respects, because the problem, I suppose, is that a registrant can submit completely bogus information or information that is valid, but they don't have any right to it to submit it for who is. Just kind of worrisome, I suppose.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments on this? Holly, anybody else? Christina? Holly, go ahead.
It's probably a question to Michaela. If it is scary, but it is desirable to have accurate who is data, how would you rephrase this so that it would perhaps be less scary, but nevertheless wind up with more accurate who is data?
I think the thing, I suppose, is the problem I see with the way they've worded this is it's based on an assumption that the registrar is trying to conceal some information, or for example, let's say there could be a software glitch which happens where, you know, the fields get reversed around in the who is output, or that for whatever reason, between when a domain is transferred between registrar A and registrar B, sometimes it's very hard for the gaining registrar to pull across accurate information from the losing registrar. And there have been issues in the past where people within the IP community have chosen that time to lodge a complaint about who is data. And it's something I think there's validity in it, but the way the IPC are pushing it, I see as being a bit problematic.
Okay. Thank you, Michaela. Christina, and then Cheryl.
Sure. I mean, I understand your concern, Michaela, and I think maybe what we need to do is to come up with some language that may accommodate your concerns. I mean, the issue that's driving this and the problem that I personally have experienced is when you file a UDRP complaint and the provider comes back and says your complaint is not in administrative compliance because the registrar has informed us that the WHIS data you provided is incorrect. But you don't have any... you don't know what the correct WHIS data is because the WHIS data that you put in your UDRP complaint is what's showing in the publicly accessible WHIS. And you also don't know how to correct it. So you're kind of in this kind of weird catch-22 that all you know is you're told it's incorrect. We're not going to tell you why or how, but you can't go forward until you correct it. So, you know, given that that is in large part what's driving this, you know, I guess there's got to be a way that we can try and figure out what would work from our end and still ensure that, you know, to the extent that we can, your concerns are accommodated. I mean, unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that people are always going, I mean, I've run across so many instances where I get really frightened phone calls from people whose contact information has been falsely identified as the registrant. And I don't think, unless until we do registrant verification, I don't know that we're going to change that. But having said that, I acknowledge that there has got to be a way to make sure that we're not getting Orwellian about this. So, you know, I'm open to any suggestions, and I think probably that, you know, the IPC would be welcome to any suggestions that we could come to in this language. But having said that, you know, I think this is a high priority from my perspective.
Cheryl, you're next.
Thank you, Steve. I was really, where Christina ended is where I want to start, that because there's some identified issues here and because we have real-world experience that says this is something that needs to be dealt with, this has to be a high priority. That said, it is only requiring a response from the registrar, and I would think, Michaela, it would be a whole lot less scary if there was a standardised set of expectations at the beginning of a process that if X, Y, and Z goes pear-shaped, you do at least, you are required to answer where that has gone wrong. So the software glitch happened answer goes into the system. I don't think it's quite, I don't see it as scary as you're portraying it. But we have to disagree sometimes, okay? It's just one of those times.
Well, Cheryl, I don't have any problem with that. It's just we had an interesting incident about a month ago where a very large furniture company decided that their solicitors would not believe that although all of our details on our website and everything else stated that we were a domain registrar and hosting company, they were convinced that we had something to do with furniture delivery. and would not believe any of the answers our solicitors provided to them. So, you know, that's why it's just, I see the extreme nutty kind of things, and that's the problem I have, not with the reasonable people.
Perhaps you should move from Ireland. And
yeah,
whoever,
okay.
May I please just make a plea, whoever is managing to have this whole page in the Adobe Room reload content so frequently, which means I've now had to adjust it back to where I can read it about 5 times during this call, could they exercise self-control, please?
Point well taken. I think Mark Trachtenberg had his hand up. And Christina, I don't know if you wanted to be heard again too, but Mark, please go ahead.
For 15.1, I mean, it seems like this really would only be applicable for the most part when the registrar is providing some sort of proxy service or privacy service. I mean, I can imagine some rare occasions when there's some technical glitch that, you know, such as the one that Michaela talked about. But, I mean, wasn't the intent of putting this in here just where, you know, from practical purposes that we all experience as trademark attorneys, when you go after a domain name that uses a privacy service that the registrar changes the information and you're forced to amend? I mean, the registrar will only have to amend when they have some knowledge that the information is inaccurate, And it would seem to me they would only have that knowledge when either A, they're providing a privacy or proxy service, or B, if they see that, you know, one of the required fields is missing.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. I think Mark and Christine have kind of summarized the catch-22 situation that this is aimed at. And I think it probably needs to be expressed a little more clearly than it is in this chart. But I also think there seemed to be a general feeling this is a high-priority item if we can clarify circumstances in which it applies.
Right. My point, just to be more clear, is, you know, I just don't really see what the concern is from the registrar perspective, since, you know, A, most of the time it's only going to apply when they have some knowledge of who the registrar should be, and B, you know, it would seem pretty easy for them to respond because they have to take some action anyway to confirm the identity in the first place. Doesn't seem much more effort to have to explain, you know, why they changed something if they did.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Michaela has his hand up, and then let's try to wrap up on 15.1.
Oh, just going to say that, you see, the difference is, see, Mark is a sane attorney. He's whereas I always look at it from the point of view of the crazy ones who seem to have fun with us for some reason. No, but I understand exactly where they're coming from. I think just maybe some kind of clarification as to which areas this is supposed to address will probably make it easier to understand.
Okay, great. I think everyone agrees with that. Let's move on to 15.2. This is dealing with the other end of the first. What we just talked about is at the beginning of a UDRP process. This is at the end when the UDRP provider is ordered a transfer, and Danny Younger's proposal is that there be a sliding scale of penalties for failure to properly implement a UDRP transfer decision leading up to termination. I'm not sure if anyone on the staff can enlighten us as to this. I'm wondering if this is already provided for in the RAA. My recollection is that there was one registrar who was deaccredited in part for repeated failure to implement UDRP transfer decisions, but I may be wrong about that. Is there? Can the staff or anyone else help us out on this? Or are there any other comments on 15.2?
Well, I've got my hand up, so I'll throw my hat in.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Michael.
I follow the deaccreditations very closely, and yeah, you're right. There was at least one case in the last 12 months where failure to implement UDRP decisions, including transfers, was one of the reasons cited for the deaccreditation. So I think this is already dealt with. It's a compliance matter, surely.
Yeah.
Okay, Margie, I think you had a comment.
I believe in the last round of amendments, we have graduated sanctions. They're not specific to UDRP, but they're just general. And so I think the difference between Danny's comments and what's in there now is that it's specifically related to a UDRP. But I need to confirm that. I have to take a look at the agreement, but that's my recollection.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so unless there's objection, I think we could consider this a low-priority item because it may already be handled under the existing agreement. But obviously, if the compliance staff has a view on it, that we would love to hear that too. 15.3, this actually goes to both the beginning and the end of the process, the UDRP process, and it really I think the key is establishment of firm and enforceable deadlines for registrars to do two things. One is to respond to the resolution provider's request for information in connection with the registrar verification processes at the inception of a UDRP proceeding, and then secondly, to provide for transfer of the domain name to the petitioner pursuant to standard and preferably simplified processes at the end of the UDRP case. But I think the main thing here is to have deadlines in the RAA, which don't exist now. So let's open the floor to discussion on this issue. Margie, did you want to be heard on this, or am I? No, you don't. Okay. Any comments on 15.3? Christina, go ahead.
Just that I think that this should be a high priority, and frankly, I would think it not only creates certainty from the trademark owner perspective, but also from the registrar in terms of kind of setting out very specifically, you know, at least with regard to the initiation and the verification, what the time expectations are. You know, obviously on the back end, the transfer, you know, that's already set out in UDRP. But I think if the compliance staff does, in fact, have kind of a window within which, you know, as long as you're within 15 days, they're not going to take any action or whatever it is, I think it, having that kind of certainty is frankly going to make things easier and allow for greater implementation of just uniform systems across the board.
Okay. Thank you, Christine. Any other comments on this? If not, we'll just mark that as a high priority item. And we now have completed through number 15, and we've also completed the time set aside for this meeting. We did get off to a bit of a late start, but I'm a little hesitant to start in on 16 because it has quite a few sub items in it. And I wonder if we can wrap it up here. Our next meeting is scheduled to be in 2 weeks. Hopefully early in the week of February 22nd, and we can get the doodle launched on that right away and get that squared away. And I think we're in sight for being able to finish up this document at the next meeting. I will mention that we have several items on which we launched some discussion on the list. And there hasn't been very much discussion. There hasn't been any discussion at all in the last several weeks. So I will work with the staff and make sure people are aware of and engaged on those items. I think it's numbers 5 through 8. And let's see if we can advance that on the list over the next 2 weeks. And if we can't, or if there are areas that we need to discuss next week, maybe after we get through item 19, we can then turn directly to those. So I will encourage everybody to do that, and maybe we'll get something around to people on that in the next couple of days. Did people have any other comments or questions that they wish to raise before we adjourn? If not, then thanks to everyone for your participation today. And we'll talk again in 2 weeks' time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
At this time, I'll conclude today's conference. You may disconnect. Thank you for your attendance.